Hey guys, my name is Peter Sohn, and you guys are listening to the Pixar Podcast.
To infinity and beyond!
So, how long is this going to take?
Squirrel!
You can't rush art.
I never look back, darling. It distracts from the now.
What's the point of going out there? They'll only laugh at me.
A stranger from the outside.
Greetings.
Hello there, Pixar fans. Welcome again to another episode of the Pixar Podcast. This is episode 141. ThePixarPodcast.com/141 is where you can find show notes for this episode. I'm Derek Clements. And we are back on the Sonoma Raceway in Sonoma, California, for another presentation about Cars 3. In the last episode of the podcast, I played a press conference with the director and producers of the film. Today, we're going to get even more deep into the story of the film with writers Mike Rich, Bob Peterson, and Kiel Murray, and story supervisor Scott Morse. I will say, if you are worried about spoilers on the film, you might want to hold this episode until you see the film next month. The writers in this presentation talk about the story of the film to some degree. They even play a full scene that has not appeared in trailers yet. I think it's a fascinating presentation, so I definitely recommend it. They talk about some things I was really surprised and fascinated to learn about. But I wanted to give that warning just in case anyone wanted to hold off until next month. If you do stick around with us, you'll hear the writers talk about some real racers who broke social barriers in the field of racing back in their day, who inspired some new characters in the film. And you'll also hear a lot about the background of new character Cruz Ramirez. Really interesting stuff about her. And they also discuss how they found and incorporated into the new movie audio footage from the archives, from Paul Newman, as well as Tom Magliozzi from Car Talk, who both passed away since they recorded their parts on the first Cars film. Both of their characters are in the new movie, and they talk about how they made that happen. Also, on the day that I released the last episode of the podcast, a new trailer for Cars 3 dropped. So before we hear about the making of the story of the film, let's take a listen to some of that.
You are about to become the biggest brand in racing.
U95! Woo-hoo!
Movie deals, infomercials, product endorsements.
Ka-chow!
You think you're famous now? We'll be rich beyond belief.
Mr. Sterling, what is this about?
Your legacy. Every time you lose, you damage yourself. I'm sorry. Your racing days are coming to an end.
We can only hope that this race today wasn't his last.
I decide when I'm done.
How you feeling?
I can't go out on the track and do the same old thing. It won't work.
It's futile to resist change, man.
You know what I'd do?
What?
I don't know. I got nothing.
I am so excited to train you. I like a challenge. I call you my senior project.
On your mark, get set, and go!
Whoa, 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 whoa!
Huh?
The beach ate me.
Jackson Storm set a new record today when he pulled off the fastest lap ever recorded.
Of course, Cars 3 comes out in the United States on June 16th. And I'll be sharing lots more information and interviews about the making of the film in the coming weeks. One note on this episode, there are three or four brief moments in the presentation where we had some audio issues. Sounds like some cell phone interference or something like that nearby. I've worked with the audio a bit to make the interruptions interfere as little as possible, but I do apologize for those. And with that, Here is a presentation about the story development process for Cars 3.
My name is Mike Rich, and I've been a screenplay writer now for a little more than 15 years, predominantly in live action. Wrote some sports films, Finding Forrester, The Rookie, and Secretariat. This is my first time working at Pixar and my first time working in animation.
And I'm Bob Peterson, a 23-year vet, story and writing and other things. I was the head of story on Monsters, Inc., one of the writers of Nemo, and writer, co-director on Up, and the voice of Doug Ross in Mr. A. That's the only way I can beat his secretariat.
I'm Kiel Murray. I'm a writer on Cars 3 and a writer on Cars 1, and I'm currently writing something for Disney Animation.
I'm Scott Morse. I was the story supervisor, head of story on Cars 3. I've been at Pixar a little over 12 years. I've worked on Ratatouille, WALL-E, Brave, Cars 2, now Cars 3.
You know, when we last saw McQueen, he was on top of the world. I mean, he's a champion. He's got a great, great life, which is good for him, but not good for us from a storytelling standpoint, because our immediate problem was making sure that he had a problem. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that we created a believable and authentic dilemma for him. I think one of the reasons why Pixar wanted me to come on board was because I did have experience in sports-related films. I mentioned Secretariat just a moment ago. Same problem in that film that we had with this film, which was Secretariat was never an underdog. You know, I mean, if you can, to create an underdog situation, no matter how big and how popular the character is. And so we actually did kind of start to explore this concept of the aging athlete. If you look at Cars 3, it's actually the third act of the Cars story. And so when McQueen was young, he was just that. He was young. He was fast. He was brash. He was cocky. He didn't need anybody to tell him anything about anything. He had the answers, and his respect for the sport of racing was really kind of limited to what was 2 feet in front of him right now. And so we wanted to tap into that because he had become a different character. He had become an older character. And so you can see here's Scott, our story supervisor, visiting with Jeff Gordon, who was only a couple of years removed from when he was going to announce his retirement. There were so many huge sports personalities, both basketball fans.
Yeah, we talked a lot about aging athletes, Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan. What do they do when their legs are springy? We've got young guys coming in. Do they crumble, or do they learn to play as an older, more wiser character? And so we talked a lot about that and how that might be extended into a universal truth outside of athletics, outside of cars or toys or whatever, the idea of persevering when you feel obsolete or when you feel like you can't go on. You have that big Y in the road of letting it destroy you or moving forward. And when you find those universal truths, you think, well, maybe that is a story that needs to be told. Anyway, that's where we were, just talking about the universal truth of aging, anybody aging or anyone reaching a place of adverse
I think athletes, some make the mistake of just trying to stay young. I was fast, I can get fast again. And the ones that adapt, Michael Jordan and others, that adapt and evolve and become, you know, tap into the things, the wisdom that perhaps they've gained over their career, those are the ones that that succeed. I remember hearing one baseball pitcher who was asked, "How am I going to know?" He was asking a question of his manager, "How am I going to know when it's starting to slip away?" And the reply he got was, "The kids will tell you." So speaking of kids, we come to Jackson Storm, who, if you think about it, it's the inverse of McQueen. in Cars 1. He has everything that McQueen had when he was young. Speed, his personality, a lot of swagger, and a little bit more of an edge than McQueen even had. But the one thing that he clearly represents is the same thing that McQueen represented to a lot of older racers when he was coming up, that he can be the one that can take from Lightning the one thing that he loves more than anything in the world, racing. And so if we're going to get that across, one of the things we knew we had to do, if we're going to get across why McQueen has, you know, what, why he loves this sport, what it means to him, we had to go out on the road, which is such a Pixar tradition, to research and find some of the things. Scott, you went on some of those early trips too.
Yeah. We realized that we needed to really grab onto that Pixar tradition of living in the material, doing the research, breathing the air of the subject matter that you're trying to put up on the screen, and really trying to understand it, not just the set pieces and the characters you might find that are interesting and new, lighting ideas and things like that, but the spirit, the story, the emotion of why something is so important. In our movie, the Piston Cup circuit is based on NASCAR, and we realized that if McQueen's going to do some self-reflecting on what he might love about the sport that he's never admitted to himself, we should dig into NASCAR's history. So we journeyed to the American South and made a lot of connections there, did a lot of roaming and poking around corners and uncovering every stone that we could find. Literally on some of the old tracks, there were stones that we had to uncover. They're dirt roads that are or dirt tracks that have been overgrown by forests, you know, that people are jogging on now, that were classic tracks back in the day, with the bleachers still up on the hill, you know, kind of rotting, and there was a real vibe to it, a real aesthetic. Even some of the old concrete tracks that we found that were asphalt tracks that have been discontinued from use, had to be mowed before they were brought in. They were so cracked and overgrown. We were bummed that they mowed them because we wanted to see them overgrown. But we talked with a lot of people that worked at these tracks. We talked with a lot of the old crew chiefs and a lot of the old drivers themselves. We sat with Junior Johnson. We realized that there was a rich history of something that we didn't anticipate finding in the sport. Rebellion was kind of this theme that kept coming up. And the whole sport was born out of rebellion. It was born out of seeing how fast you could go because they were literally outrunning the cops. They were running moonshine back in the day. And as they would soup up their engines, it started to become an ego race of can I make my car faster than my buddy's car? Not just the cops, but you know, so they started to square off against each other in the cornfields and the wheat fields on Sunday morning, and you know, making the preachers mad. Rebelling against Sunday, even.
The moonshine, it was the waking people up on Sunday.
It was, and it kept evolving. And then they tried to sanction it and make it the NASCAR sport that it is, and they brought in rules, and all the drivers kind of looked at each other, and the crew chiefs looked at each other and went, well, how are we going to get around the rules? And they'd soup up their cars and add secrets to the cars, and there was always this spirit of rebellion kind of throughout. We realized maybe that's in McQueen's blood, and he has never really analyzed what that means and really dug that deep, even with his time with Doc.
Right. We went to the Daytona 500, but we also went to the Daytona 500 library, which is more of a museum than a library. There were no computer searches in there. It was just, you know, this person saying, you want to know about Wendell Scott? Go over to a file cabinet, ratchet it out, and pull out these old yellow newspapers and photographs. It was fantastic. It's where we learned about Louise Smith. I mean, some of these greats from back in the day who had, you know, societal obstacles that confronted them from getting onto the track.
Could you explain a little more about Wendell Scott, who he was?
Well, Wendell Scott was an African American who was one of the true greats, just legendary for his innate feel for racing, but just, you know, because of that.
He's up against social barriers.
He was up against social barriers.
In the South, I mean, what we discovered real quick, this was the 50s. And when we were at Okinichi, one of these ghost tracks that's a dirt track now, there's the cheering section, and then there was the colored cheering section, and it's still there. But it turned out that one of our guides there, he happened to be a Wendell Scott aficionado, and we're like, who's this Wendell Scott you're talking about? He's like, well, we actually have one of his cars. We got to find out about Wendell, about how he was his own mechanic, about how he would bring his family every week, how he'd win races and they wouldn't give him the prize. All these things that were against him, he kept coming back. he kept coming back and he made friends and he was in the circuit through the, until he passed away, I think.
Yeah. Louise was the same way. So that was, I mean, just discovering that it was, we realized it's kind of that old adage, you know, that your parents would tell you before you cross the street, look both ways. It kind of applies to, you know, the way that you should approach, you know, look to the future, look to the past as well. And so, you know, we've got McQueen, who had just this amazing connection with Doc Hudson. And so throughout these research trips and throughout the brainstorming, we started to put together the puzzle. We started to get the puzzle pieces for our story. And then it turned into putting the pieces together. It was months and months and months before I ever wrote a word of script. We sat down, here's Scott, and here's our director, Brian Fee, and we would toss ideas out. Good ideas, bad ideas. If there were good ideas, we made them better. If there were bad ideas, they were gone. I write a short outline, and then it would become a longer outline, and then, you know, take a stab at scenes. We'd read these to John Lasseter, and, you know, you'd either get a thumbs up or you'd go back to work. And even if you got a thumbs back up, you went back to work. But one of the other things that is just the beauty of Pixar is that they constantly allow the story and the characters to evolve by allowing me to have the story for a while and then moving it on to other writers who can take it to the next level.
Yeah, Keel and I came in as a team. Keel had worked early on in the development process, way early on in this movie, and I came in, we both came in about a year ago. We're both former athletes. I was a basketball player in high school, and you were a college volleyball player. And not that that plays too much into it, but if you ask an animator about basketball, they'll say, what is it? Is that with the stick or the... So it was a treat for us to come as close to a sports movie as we possibly could at Pixar, and so that was great. And we brought just different perspectives about life, and all through our history at Pixar, you know, there's new horses or new fresh eyes have always helped. Lee Unkrich coming on to Monsters, Inc. and Lee Unkrich coming on to Finding Nemo and Lee Unkrich. But there's always been some help from outside coming in, and that's really benefited us. And so we inherited this terrific structure, this great story, a character that had a great dilemma, and some side characters that were doing really well but weren't necessarily focused enough to push Lightning McQueen into where he needed to be with his flaw of trying not to age gracefully, essentially. And so our first job was to try to focus a side character, and that became Cruz Ramirez. And it was very difficult to crack her, and we had tried a lot of different things with Cruz. She was just a pure techie and a super fan and an assistant, and none of that seemed to push McQueen as hard as we wanted to push him. She was always smart and she was always capable, but never quite meshed. And so we put ourselves on the task of focusing her a bit more. And what we ended up with is a personal trainer who treats McQueen like an old guy. And it's exactly what he doesn't want to hear, that he's her senior project and all that stuff. But she is going to push him to a place of self-recognition. And She's of that next generation, and so just to look at her is tough for him. But in his mind, he needs to train like the young people, and which is an incorrect assumption. He needs to be young again, and it does not work out for him. And it's so, you know, we start off as this sort of conversation between the older and the younger generation, where McQueen is not looking at the truth. The truth is he's old, and he's got to accept it and go on from there. And she's accepted a bad truth about herself, that she never could be a racer. And so the two sort of heal each other and give each other things along the way. And she's never been out on the road. She's never raced on a real track. She's always been on simulators. And so McQueen has that to bring to her as we go along as well. So and so from there, we cast Cristela Alonso, who helped us, again, solidify, as much as Ed Asner helped us solidify Carl and Up. She's, you know, when you wrote, you could hear her voice, and her own story was interesting in illuminating Cruz. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, Christella was great as we were trying to put together. I mean, I should say, it was clear what McQueen needed for her to be, but once we knew, okay, he needs someone to push him, we wanted to know, who is she? What's her own thing? McQueen aside, who is Cruz? And Christella's personal story was helpful. She talked to us about trying to break into comedy, how tough that was to just look and sound different than everybody else at the time. You know, growing up in a small town with sort of low expectations placed on her and having to try to exceed that on her own, dealing with confidence stuff. I looked at my own daughter, who is super successful, and yet if you ask her, she'll always undercut. You know, her expectation is always low, and she always sort of exceeds her own expectations, but it doesn't seem to change the inner monologue. I should say, and I haven't said this in any of the sessions, but this just happened this week. They were doing like a speech contest, and she said, well, I want to be top five because that's cool, but I don't want to win because then I have to do it in front of my whole grade, and I could never do that, Mama. I could never do it. And of course she won, and of course she had to do it, and then she did it, and it was great. And I'm sure the next time it'll be the same thing. So I was really interested in that because I have boys too who don't doubt themselves at all. And I started to read up on confidence in girls, and there's a lot of research now in the last few years about the confidence gap and self-limiting, sort of assessing your own ability in a second and walking away, just assuming that you can't pull it off. So we tried that with Cruz, and we tried it in scenes, and we showed women at Pixar. We also had a great story artist on our team that was a female who did a lot of work with Cruz, and I worked with her closely on it, and she has a personal story about coming to Pixar that really resonates with Cruz's story. So we had a lot of great pieces going into forming her.
And that, you know, that kind of gives you an idea of how we figure out what the heck we want to say with that movie. You know, we put it on paper, we get it up, and we get it working on the page, but at the end of the day, we stop and we realize we work in a movie studio. You know, we need to see it, we need to feel it, we need to experience it, we need to put it on the screen. And that's where the story department comes in at that point. Our crew ranges anywhere between 8 and 12 people typically. And we're kind of the first line of defense again to buffer the story and really troubleshoot it with the writers and the director, and I'm there to kind of help guide that a little bit. And we look through the pages, and we challenge what's there, and we question it, and then we start drawing it. And as you're doing that, and we do, you know, 9 to 12 versions of reels for any one of our movies, and that can take years, a couple of years. And we see and we feel what's wrong with the movie as we go, and we course correct as we go. It's tricky because you always run into these trouble sequences on films. And Cruz's Dreams, the last sequence of the chunk of the movie you guys have seen at this point, where we hear Cruz's backstory a little bit, was always a bit of a tough nut to crack. We knew mechanically where it needed to be in the film. We knew it was a pivot point for Lightning McQueen to kind of see that there were things that he was overlooking in his life and in other people's lives, a point of view that he never would stop to think about. But it wasn't coming alive yet. We had a couple different board artists try their hand at it, and it worked, but it wasn't emotional. It occurred to us to put our friend Louise Smythe on it. She was a newer board artist at the studio. Super bubbly, super excited to be there, super excited to do a good job, secretly hiding this fact in her mind that she was suffering from what she calls imposter syndrome. She was a newer artist at Pixar, and you know, she grew up wanting to work at Pixar, and now that she was there, she was feeling like, I don't know that I can do this. I don't know that I can do this job. I don't know that I'm as good as the people around me. I don't know that I can do what's expected of me. And we kind of recognized that. We pulled Keel in the room, and we gave her the sequence and said, this is exactly what Cruz is going through. We need your perspective on this. We need your point of view, and you're gonna sell this better than anyone. She took the challenge on. She put on her headphones and started working on visuals for what this would look like. And as with all the board artists, we hand out the script pages, and she dug into them and asked questions and asked the right questions. about Cruise and what Cruise is going through in McQueen. Started doing just really rough little thumbnails. They start out real small for, you know, we're looking for clarity on film language. What do we do? And Bob was saying earlier that...
Well, yeah, on Bug's Life, when I was drawing on that one, Joe Ramp came around, and when you're doing thumbnails, he said, cut out a little set of silhouetted human heads and stick it on the bottom of the thing, and you'll get a sense of what it would be like being in the theater looking at.
Because we always forget we're drawing this size for something that's huge. It's for a movie theater. It's not for an iPad or a phone. It'll look good if it's that size. We know that because we're drawing it that size, but we're drawing it for a big screen. And you always have your main character in mind in your movie when you're doing that. And with this movie, Lightning McQueen was taking up a lot of screen real estate, both with his dialogue and his story and his ego and his mouth and his physical size. He was always crowding other characters out of frame. He was always taking up more screen. He was a little closer than other characters. He was our prominent spotlit character. We knew that this was a pivot point, that he was going to have to shut up and listen to somebody else for a minute for his story to progress. And Louise recognized that, and she said, you know, I've got these ideas for how to stage this, to flop that screen real estate a little bit, pull Cruz a little bit closer, isolate her in frame, center her for a little bit, when she blows up at McQueen, and then have her be more prominent for this moment, minimize Lightning McQueen. And she's growing into that role by admitting it for the first time. That's a really big thing. And we go through iterations on these things, searching and finding. Even when we get it down into editorial, we realize maybe the wrong person's talking during these scenes sometimes. You know, McQueen was speaking a lot during the scene at one point. We realized if he's talking, he's not listening. We need to minimize his voice too. So we started to pull his lines out and really make it more about Cruz being able to have this stage for once.
Did someone overwrite that scene too?
I think Keel probably was really excited about it.
I wrote the good parts too.
Talking to Mick Cockerson, getting his words out. Anyhow, we thought it would be fun to show you some of the dirty laundry. We don't stop with our boards until we know it's emotionally elevated material that is going to work as a movie. We don't get it. We try not to send it to animation until then. And this wasn't ready for a long time. We wanted to show you the last version that we thought, okay, now finally, it's rough, it's crude, the music's not quite right, but the part of it is there. I think I'm feeling it right, and animation can take it from here. So we thought we'd show you that clip.
Tonight's unexpected appearance of Lightning McQueen.
He has always been my favorite. My garage is covered from head to toe with 95 posters.
So, trophy's kind of nice, don't you think? I mean, I know you got like a billion of them, so you would know. I still can't believe I won. It's pretty shiny. I have never seen one up close. Looks like they spent a lot of money on it. I mean, I think it's real money.
Stop. Just stop, okay, Cruz? You don't even know. You don't even have one clue.
Hey, I was just trying to...
Do you know what happens if I lose this race? Every mile of this trip was to get me faster than Jackson Storm. Faster! I start off getting nowhere for a week on a simulator. I lose a whole day with you on Fireball Beach, and then I waste a night in the crosshairs of Miss Fritter! I'm stuck in the same speed I was a month ago! I can't get any faster because I'm too busy taking care of my trainer! This is my last chance, Cruz. Last, final, finito. If I lose, I never get to do this again. If you were a racer, you'd know what I'm talking about, but you're not. So you don't.
Mac, pull over.
What? Now?
Now. Ask me if I dreamed of being a trainer, Mr. McQueen. Go ahead. Ask me if I got up in the dark to run laps before school every day. Ask me if I saved every penny to buy a ticket to the races when they came to town. Ask me if I did that so that I could be a trainer someday. Ask me. No! I've wanted to become a racer forever. Because of you. I used to watch you on TV, flying through the air. You seemed so fearless. Dream small, Cruz. That's what my family used to say. Dream small or not at all. They They were just trying to protect me. But I was the fastest kid in town, and I was gonna prove them wrong.
What happened?
When I got to my first race, I figured it out.
What?
That I didn't belong. The other racers looked nothing like me. You know, they were bigger and stronger and so confident. And when they started their engines, that was it. I knew I'd never be a racer. I just left. It was my one shot, and I didn't take it. Yeah, so I'm gonna head back to the training center. I think we both know it's for the best. But can I ask you something? What was it like for you when you showed up to your first race? How did you know you could do it?
I don't know. I just never thought I couldn't.
I wish I knew what that felt like. Good luck, Mr. McQueen.
Cruz, wait.
So, you know, as we board these things, boards are so important to really stumble and fall and find our way and discover what's right and what's wrong at all aspects of these movies. And we, you know, you struggle looking for the emotion and for the suspense, and comedy is probably one of the hardest things for us to find. Find the right amount of, find the right place to put it, find the right tone. Is it taking away from your main characters? But that's kind of in a nutshell how we approach the writing on these things.
Questions go.
From the footage that we've seen, it seems like a lot of the story resonates a lot with the first Cars, and we don't see as much of stuff from Cars 2. Is that something that you guys, do you guys feel like it's more spiritually related to the first Cars in some way, or how do you guys think about that?
I think that's a good way to say it, more spiritually related.
Right. It just seemed like a natural, like I said, you know, if you look at it from a standpoint of McQueen is aging, well, let's spend time when he's really young as well, so those two. It seemed like a natural partnership.
Yeah, and I mean, really, you know, Cars 1 is like McQueen's movie. Cars 2 was Mater's movie, and it asked to be a different kind of film because of who that lead was. But both of those films really do help us with Cars 3 because they establish that Lightning McQueen is at the top of his game. He's a world champion. Nothing can touch him. He's immortal in his own mind. What could go wrong, right? And that helped. That actually, what, you know, that was the problem we were presented with to figure out, but it gave us a really interesting way to begin a Cars 3 if we were going to readdress that this is Lightning McQueen's story that we want to resolve or continue as his career. What do you give a guy who has everything, right? There's not much more he can achieve in life except more wins. Maybe you have to look at the flip side of that and challenge him and take it away.
Yeah, I mean, we just wanted to make this emotional, make this an emotional, meaningful film, you know. And, you know, if it conjures up some of the Americana and nostalgia and the friendship and the community of the first one, that's great.
That's what it did for me. I mean, yeah. Just these friendships, these unique friendships, and you'll see more of them, you know, throughout the film. I mean, just, you know, throwbacks to, I love that. I love living in that.
Any other cameos? Like, will we see Chick Hicks or anybody else?
Yeah,
you saw Chick Hicks.
Yeah, haven't you seen him already?
Did you watch the clips?
Was Chick in
the chunk of the movie from last night?
Yeah, he's in the front.
He was the talk show with Natalie.
He does the voice, yeah. So if you might hear a little piece.
He sounds like this. Hello, Wazowski. Yeah. I took up for Michael Keaton on this one, but yeah, that's maybe that's why you didn't know that was Chick Hicks, but
he's in there.
Did you spot the Pizza Planet truck? I guess we weren't being as clandestine as we could have been.
So there was an interesting challenge in this film that you don't necessarily face in all films from a writing aspect, which is several of the characters have passed. Whether it be Tom Magliozzi or we've heard at least in the teaser that there's some elements of Paul Newman's voice in this from Doc Hudson. So what are the constraints that come along with that from a writing perspective, knowing that you have to fit in those defined lines that are already pre-recorded?
I mean, I'll say that there was so much great Paul Newman stuff that, and also I remember because I was on that film, they kept it rolling all the time, even when he was just telling stories and wasn't recording stuff. So it was really just a matter of listening to it all. And there was enough, I mean, we wouldn't write around it in the sense that I kind of knew, honestly, anytime you hear his voice, it's just good. I feel like it just cuts through. So that was one of my goals when I came on. I was like, can we have more? Can we have more? Can someone listen to all of it? And people said the editors wrote up everything. So then it was just actually the choice of choosing, because there was a lot of great stuff to choose from.
We found things that fit pretty well.
And in the case of Tom, like you bring up, that's a similar situation, but different in a lot of ways, because that character is still very much alive in the film. So there's conversation that happens between the two brothers and McQueen and other characters. So you have to craft those, you have to find the, not with my brother, they're not, you have to find those from old past recordings, and they were very gracious with the estate and let us kind of go through a lot of old recordings, and our editor, Jason Hudak, is a magician, some evil magician, the soul of the devil that can craft and bring the dead back to life somehow.
I'm sure he'll love that in print.
Yeah. Yeah.
What did you say?
I hope you all read
Jason
that.
Hudak,
Satanist.
And John tells the story that how impish he was, Paul Newman, like on set, he would do all these silly things, kind of like your grandpa would do. Like one time he took a water bottle, and I hope this doesn't break, but no one knew it was back there, and he was like, oh, I got to crack my neck. That's a bottle, you know. And so we're like, oh, boy, how could we use that? And we have one moment of impishness coming up of Paul Newman. And just to sort of pay homage to the fact that he was kind of like that in real life. You know?
His spirit is still very...
Look at my salad dressing.
So on those, is there a mix of new, like people acting, recording new, you're using old footage and new footage, or is it in those cases?
It's just real stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, it's new footage with audio.
I mean, in the case of Tom and Ray, I think...
That had to be crafted very specifically.
He could carry the bulk of the lines, and then you could use real stuff.
Yeah. Cool. We wanted to make sure we got that. Don't drive like my brother.
Those have to be in there.
Yeah.
In the half of the movie we saw, it seemed like Mater's not in it too much. Is he more in the other half of the movie, or?
Mater's definitely in the film.
You'll see him.
He's and Mater. Talking about Mater, he's a very interesting character. We approached him. There's two different ways you can approach Mater. As the clown who's just there filling the room with hot air, which is fun, or as Lightning McQueen's best friend and all the good things that can come with being able to have a conversation with your best friend. And we lean into both. But we definitely analyzed how best to use Mater and where that's going to help McQueen's story.
There's a couple scenes in there that were some of the favorites that I... for me to write, because it's almost when you know you're settling in, you're writing a scene with McQueen and Mater, you just get this kind of, it's like comfort food, I mean, you just feel good, and because you can hear those voices so clearly.
Yeah, and in our when we showed the screening early on to people, when Mater comes on screen, people just go, they love Mater.
About one more question.
Okay. Kind of talking about those kinds of screenings, Cars kind of is an interesting property for Pixar just because it's remained so evergreen, I think in large part due to toys, and so there's always new kids, and then now we've got, people who were kids with the original film but are now adults. So with those screenings, like, how do you guys choose which kids you're paying attention to make sure that they're still, like, engaged and focused at the same time as it's resonating with adults?
We don't do any of that. I mean, I'm sure Disney chooses, but at the screening that we were at, they have screenings that are for full families, right?
Full spectrum of ages.
It was every age, every.
And they don't know what they're coming to see when they sit down, and they know what type of film they're going to see. So watching their reactions is always a lot of fun, and seeing it reminds us that, like, oh yeah, that was funny. Good, I'm glad we left that joke in. Because it wasn't funny for 4 years straight. That's what we were playing with it.
But there, people, even the little kids got the film. And one little girl on her mother's lap in the session afterwards said,
I think girls can do anything boys can do, you know, and that was interesting. And then you talk to the little boys, and they're like, wow, I love the Demolition Derby, and I love McQueen, and, you know, so it seemed like it was appealing to the whole family, which was nice.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you
so
much.
Okay, Squirt here will now give you a rundown of proper exiting technique.
It's just my ball.
Don't let it happen again.
Yes, well, I'll try to be less careless.
It's got this kind of smoky, melty. It's not really a smoky taste. It's a certain, it's kind of like a... It's kind of like this boom, sap kind of taste. Don't you think? What would you call that flavor?
Lightning?
Don't look at the light!
I can't help it. It's so beautiful.
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you.
Gone! It's all gone. All of it's gone. Bye-bye. Woo, see ya.
Thank you for listening to the Pixar Podcast.